This is Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. Welcome to a special broadcast of Morning Edition with a live audience at the George Washington Carver Museum Cultural and Genealogy Center in Austin. We are gathering here today and devoting the following hour to discussing a complicated, sensitive, yet important topic, Austin's racial climate. Austin has a reputation as a liberal city and a decidedly conservative state. You know, the blueberry and the tomato soup, as some people like to say. We're thought of as a tolerant and progressive city. But that really depends on who you ask. Communities of color in Austin have said for years that climate of tolerance and acceptance does not extend to them. And that's what we're discussing in depth today. But sadly, this conversation has taken center stage because of a series of bombings in Austin earlier this month. Two people were killed and four people were injured in four bombings in Austin. A fifth bomb exploded at a FedEx facility in Schertz outside of San Antonio, and a sixth bomb was found at the FedEx facility near Austin-Bergstrom International Airport. Before we get into the discussion, let's revisit the evolution of the serial bombings.
I know you all will ask whether this is terrorism related. Again, there is no information that we have right now to believe this is anything other than an isolated incident.
I remember Stephen being just quiet most of the time. It was always a no small talk type conversation with him. I like that about him.
Police had believed a package bomb that killed a 39-year-old man in Austin on March 2nd was an isolated incident. But now there are two more bombings under nearly identical circumstances.
The 17-year-old boy that was murdered has been identified as Draylen Mason. And from everything I've heard about Draylen, he was an outstanding young man.
That is heartbreaking. Innocent people, we don't know what's going on or why somebody would do that.
We are not ruling out terrorism or not ruling out hate.
What really made me the most upset, besides obviously the loss of life, was that it might be racially motivated. That's what made me feel sick.
I don't think the community is responding in a way of fear. It's just about what can we do and how can we come together to either prevent these things from happening or be there for each other.
Police received a call around 8:30 Sunday evening about an explosion in the Travis Country neighborhood.
Is this terrorism? Is this hate related? That is something that we're going to analyze. We are clearly dealing with what we expect to be a serial bomber.
The use of the tripwire and the device yesterday, it changes it from a more of a targeted approach to a more random approach.
What we've done now is we start to write down what day packages are supposed to arrive and when.
Schertz police responded to a call for a blast at the FedEx distribution facility.
A package had been traveling along the automated conveyor when it had exploded.
The FBI confirmed that there were, in fact, two suspicious packages found in FedEx facilities.
I understand the last one, the mailed package, I think will lead to more evidence. Hopefully fingerprints and surveillance photos.
And then after he was seen and his vehicle was seen on the cameras at the FedEx office, within hours, they pieced all of this information together.
As members of the Austin Police Department SWAT team approached the vehicle, the suspect detonated a bomb inside the vehicle.
You literally had Austin police officers running towards a vehicle that had an explosive device in it. That detonated. That is unbelievable courage.
This is really good news that we have now. But yes, the investigation is continuing.
What I can tell you, having listened to that recording, he does not at all mention anything about terrorism.
You know, that's a terrorist. Like someone who's changing people's lives for the worse and then, you know, making them feel terrorized.
Even though the words are enormously similar, there's a vast difference between being terrorized and what terrorism is. The act of violence has to be placed within a larger context of some political movement or of a broader ideological framework.
He did refer to himself as a psychopath. He did not show any remorse. In fact, questioning himself as to why he didn't feel remorse for what he did. And it's hard to imagine someone whose mind is so sick.
To be clear, the suspect in this incident rained terror on our community for almost 3 weeks. This investigation continues. We will identify, if possible, any motive.
produced by KUT's Nathan Bernier. And joining me now is KUT's Saida Hassan. She covers City of Austin issues, including housing, affordability, and development. Hello, Saida.
Hi, Jen.
So, Saida, you've been talking to lots of people to hear their reactions to the serial bombings, to the fact that the first four victims of the bombings were people of color, and the racial climate that exists in Austin today. So tell us a little bit about who you've talked to and what you've been hearing.
So one of the people I talked to that really helped us sort of put this recent series of attacks into a historical context is Eric Tang. He's an assistant professor of African American and Asian American studies at UT Austin. And Tang says that to understand the particular effects of the bombings on communities of color, we really need to put the bombings into a larger historical context. And his research has focused on why many people of color displaced by gentrification or otherwise have chosen to leave Austin, as well as why some other folks have chosen to stay.
And they stayed because they were resilient and they want to continue to hold on to that sense of community, despite having been segregated there to begin with, followed by rapid displacement of their communities owing to gentrification. And what they feel is that very few people in this city acknowledge that history. So this is the context, right, in which three package bombs go off in East Austin.
So Saida, that's some context for this story, that Austin has a history of segregation. It was solidified by the 1928 master plan for Austin that codified segregation in the city by race, and more recently, displacement of communities of color from those neighborhoods. And there's definitely a belief that poor treatment of communities of color has persisted over time.
Yes, and that's a feeling that was really summed up by another person we talked to. Her name is Christina Brown, and she's the co-founder of a group called Counterbalance ATX.
Now we're having conversations about why when the first bomb went off, there was not a heightened awareness and attention given to the issue. Why was he considered really a suspect even after he died, as opposed to being a victim? Those are conversations that people are having even on the national level. And I think it's appropriate. I think it's long due past that we start having those conversations here. But even more importantly, I think that we need to have some action behind that.
So some of those feelings that Christina described really prompted discussion amongst a lot of folks that we've talked to about what to call the serial bombings. You know, are they terrorism? Are they not? And I spoke with Sheldon Laney, who is the president of Pflugerville Black Business Builders. And Sheldon says that the language used to talk about these attacks, in particular, the decision not to officially label the bomber as a terrorist, has been frustrating.
When you terrorize the whole city, it's no other word but to call terrorists, because everybody was scared. They, you know, I had one friend say that her son was scared to go to school because he was scared that maybe a package bomb might show up to the school and everything. That was here in Pflugerville. So it was a terrorist act.
And Saida, I talked recently with Austin Mayor Steve Adler about what we do with all of this, both with the aftermath of the bombings themselves and the problems in Austin that they have laid bare. And here's what he told me.
And my hope is that the real legacy of this is that we'll take a little bit deeper look at ourselves and recognize that we don't know each other the way that we should. And this is now the moment to say we're going to do better on that, that it's more than just a feel-good kind of thing. This is a serious way that a community helps one another.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler talking about the work ahead for Austin to heal from the serial bombings and to improve the racial climate at Austin that we have been reminded of as this case played out. Thank you, KUT's Saida Hassan. She covers City of Austin issues, including housing, affordability, and development. And coming up, we're going to hear from a panel of Central Texas activists and interim Austin Police Chief Brian Manley about the bombings and the response by police, the community, and the media, and where we go from here. That's next as Morning Edition on KUT 90.5 continues live from the Carver Museum in Austin. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's Morning Edition on KUT 90.5. I'm Jennifer Staten. We are broadcasting live this morning from the Carver Museum in Austin, where we've brought people together to discuss the recent serial bombings in Austin, and more specifically, what those bombings have revealed about Austin's racial climate. Austin likes to think of itself as a tolerant and progressive place, but that assessment is not shared by communities of color here. We're discussing that today in the aftermath of the bombings. And joining me to dig deeper into this is our panel now. I'll introduce each of you. Emlyn Lee is founder and community collaborator at Brave Communities, building relationships, awareness, voices, engagement in communities. The organization's mission is to unite students, businesses, nonprofits, and community groups by sharing our stories and voices so we may understand, embrace, and empower each other to become a more integrated community. Gilbert Rivera is president of the Rosewood Neighborhood Association. He's also a lifelong resident of East Austin and an outspoken neighborhood activist. Gilbert and his wife, Jane Rivera, co-authored a book on the history of Austin's Rosewood neighborhood. He's long been a critic of the effects of ongoing gentrification in East Austin and is a regular at public meetings, weighing in on the future of Austin. Chaz Moore is executive director and founder of the Austin Justice Coalition. The group's mission is to provide the tools for people of color and people who are marginalized to improve their lives. Chaz founded the organization in 2015 and has been an activist in Austin for more than 10 years. Brian Manley is interim Austin Police Chief. He's been with the Austin Police Department since 1990 and has served in and supervised many areas, including patrol, narcotics, child abuse, homicide, highway enforcement, internal affairs, special operations and homeland security, and recruiting and training. He's been interim chief since November of 2016. And we thank you all so much for joining us this morning. So I have questions for all of you this morning, some from us at KUT, some from our listeners, but I hope you treat this as an opportunity for interaction and dialogue with each other. So I invite you to respond and comment on each other's answers, also to ask each other questions as they occur to you as our discussion goes forward. So first of all, I want to start with, and would love to hear from each of you, your assessments of Austin's racial climate right now. Where are we? How are we in 2018? And anybody just hop on in to start?
Chaz? Me?
All right, Chaz, you're first.
Yeah, I thought some of the OGs would want to go first. You know, I tell people all the time, I'm originally from Houston. I came here to go to the University of Texas in 2006. And in Houston, I came from a Black and Latino community in Southwest Houston. And I kind of jokingly tell people the only time I saw white people in Houston was when we went to Target. And then I get here in 2006, my first day of school at the University of Texas, you know, four white gentlemen in a blue pickup truck tell me to go home. I don't know what I can say on live radio or live TV, but they told me to go home N-word. So that let me know that, you know, even in 2006, I'm thinking that race is something that is something that's still real, but it wasn't something as prevalent as it was in the 60s and before. So that kind of just set the tone for what Austin was for me. And then, you know, after my time at the University of Texas, I'm coming be a part of the community. I'm on the east side and learning about the 1928 master plan, looking at East Austin. When I got here to East Austin now, to you couldn't pay a white person to come to 12th and Chacon. And now they're on 12th and Chacon walking in poodles and Labradors. It's the craziest thing to me. But the only reason that is because the population of black people that are in East Austin now has changed dramatically, right? Like when you think about all the black businesses that were still booming and still there, they're no longer there. So like now we got these salons and stuff and all this kind of crazy stuff on the east side. That makes sense as to why it's poodles and jogging and these little bike session things that they be doing at nighttime, all this kind of crazy stuff. But I think that speaks volumes into this myth that we're all together, that we all, you know, this big, beautiful, diverse pie. When the fact that these people are only on the east side because the black presence is gone. So I think that speaks a little bit about the racial tensions in Austin.
And I'd love to hear from all of you, yes.
And I'll jump in. I think, again, Chaz pointed out, you know, how Austin was kind of founded in the master plan. And I think that we've come a long way from those days. But there's still work to be done. And I think as a city, we address that. And I think we are a progressive city, but I think we're always going to have to pay attention to that. You know, there's been examples of this, the mayor's institutional task force on, or task force on institutional racism. You know, when I went to high school here in Austin, we had integration because Austin was so segregated, and there were attempts being made even back in the 80s to segregate and to blend and to get everyone together. So I think we're a city that has a history that we have to acknowledge of where we started from and the steps we've made to do better. And that needs to be our focus as we continue to work to the future to continue to build the relationships and address those issues that are either real or perceived, because if they are perceived, they are real. And so we have to address that.
Emlyn and Gilbert, are we doing better?
No. No. If anything, we're doing worse, because from my perspective, what I see is a lot of the overt attacks on people of color from the past are now institutionalized. And by that I mean the way city policies, city ordinances, etc., are initiated in downtown. In the past, they used to move us with the barrel of a gun. Today, they move us with ordinances. It's no different. They continue to move us out and destroy our neighborhoods. I was born and raised here in Austin. I was one of the original founders of the Brown Berets here in Austin. And the reason I started that was because one day in 1972, I was severely beaten by the Austin Police Department. And I'm not the only one. The problem that we had then was that we did not have cell phones, so we could not record what happened to me and many other people. So we started the Brown Berets and quickly aligned ourselves, and with the support of the Black Citizens Task Force and the Black Panther Party here in Austin. And we became a united group. And I think that's something that we need to continue today as people of color. We need to continue to be united, because we are facing institutional racism. And institutional racism did not start in 1928. It started when the first pilgrims stuck their flag in Plymouth Rock. That's when it started. As they moved westward, many of my brothers and sisters, indigenous peoples, were wiped out. Our religious shrines, for example, in the Dakotas, the Black Hills are spiritual to the Lakota. What they did over there, they put monuments to their forefathers. Here in what was once Mexico, the Mexican American people are probably the only people in the United States besides the Native American, and in fact we are indigenous also, that live under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. We are a people that are occupied. So when you tell me that things are getting better as a person living in his homeland under the rule of an occupier, I have a problem with that. We when this happened, the bombing happened, and I will call him a domestic terrorist, because that's what he was, and that's what he is, and that's what he will always be. I don't understand how, when a whole community is terrorized, the officials say, well, technically, by definition, it's not defined, because it wasn't against a certain group of people or the government. Well, domestic terrorism under the Patriot Act is defined as any attack on a person, an institution, that breaks the laws of the state and the country. This person did all of the above. So he is and will always be, in my book, a domestic terrorist. And when he did that, it brought up everything that is part of our DNA, having been facing all of these conflicts from day one.
And Emlyn, I do want to get your answer to this first question, but Chief, I want to ask, we got this question lots of times since the case has unfolded, from listeners, from folks in the community. Can you respond to that language that's been used about the serial bomber?
Certainly, and I'm glad to be given the opportunity, because this is a distinction that I did want to make today. I will say through the weeks, the couple weeks of investigation we were doing with the serial bomber unleashing this violence in our community, I was very driven and very laser focused on the investigation, on finding the suspect who was responsible for this or the suspects, and putting a stop to the violence in the community. Knowing that it might end up in a legal system at some point, I was being very specific on legal definitions that exist under federal law, because if this ended up being prosecuted, I was being very focused on the investigation. Over this past week, as I've reflected now that the investigation, although it continues, we've dealt with the suspect in this incident, I've had an opportunity to sit back and reflect on the impact that it had on our community, and not be centered and focused on the investigation and try and put a stop to it. And when I look at what he did to our community, and as your police chief, I actually agree now that he was a domestic terrorist for what he did to us. But in that moment, I want you to understand I was so focused on putting a stop to it and making sure we did it in a way that allowed us to handle the suspect or suspects in a court system in the future, I was very focused on specific language. I've now had the opportunity to sit back and understand and absorb all of the impacts that it had on a personal level. And that is why I sit here today, and I am very comfortable saying that to our community and what he did to us, he was a domestic terrorist.
So, Chief, it was the facts of the impact that changed your thinking. It was the actual facts of the case. What, because I think there were people who felt it from the very beginning, legal definition or not, that that's what was going on. What was it that tipped your thinking?
I think what actually allows me to and I'm always willing to change my opinion, and why I have, is now that I have taken everything into consideration, his actions along with the impact that it had on this community, I have now changed my opinion, and I do believe that he was a domestic terrorist for what he did to us here in Austin.
Emlyn, I want to get back to you as we continue our discussion, and have you weigh in on what you think about Austin's racial climate right now.
Right. To tag on with what Chaz and Gilbert were saying, I do think that we think that Austin's getting better because we have more food trucks and more diverse restaurants and murals that have different people on walls. But as far as the connection and the true relationships, and to really integrate the diversity of Austin, I don't think it's there. I came in Austin 2001, coming from a suburb of Washington, D.C., and then international for about 7 years. And when I moved to Austin, I actually thought, I was like, wow, this is one of the most segregated cities that I've been to. And that was back in 2001. And now that, you know, it's 2018, and we're definitely growing. We're now the 11th populated city in America. The changes that are happening are unfortunately becoming more of a divide, in my opinion. And so how we are able to do that, I think, is a collective space, you know, but that is a lot of what Gilbert was saying. It's the institution, it's the structures, but then making the individual efforts of really trying to break the divide and to really get more involved with the community and stepping outside our comfort zones.
Well, and we definitely, as our panel continues, we want to talk about ways to try to improve this, ways we can come together, and ways that we can get better. I want to touch in on a couple of questions that we got from listeners as we were talking about the panel and putting the panel together. And these questions are related to the bombing case in particular, but bigger picture questions also. We received a bigger picture question from a listener about crimes against people of color in Austin. And the question is, what is the recent history of and any current statistics for racially motivated hate crimes in Austin, and how is that specifically identified? Because, of course, in the bombing case, the first four victims were people of color, the subsequent two were not. How, when a person of color is a victim of a crime, how is that defined? When does it become a hate crime? How is that explored and investigated?
So there's specific language in law that is required to make it a hate crime. And we actually have a hate crimes task force that we sit on along with our other partners in the criminal justice system so that we can pay attention to crime and hate crime that occurs in our community, and that we make sure that if it falls into the definition of the hate crime, that we are identifying it and that we are then prosecuting it under the appropriate statute. So we look for specific indicators, again, similar to what we were doing in the investigation into the bombings, to identify if there is an ideology behind it that is focused on hate and on selecting a specific race. So again, we participate there. Austin Travis County has a hate crimes task force that we sit on. And this is a group that regularly looks at these issues in our community to make sure that we're addressing them appropriately within the criminal justice system.
And for our panelists, yes, Gilbert.
I don't remember recently in the history of Austin, I don't remember ever, and maybe there have been instances where a crime has been defined as a hate crime. Maybe there have been. But I can tell you this, the way people of color are treated here in Austin, Texas, the way we see young people of color being shot on the streets, unarmed, unclothed, just by merely walking, those are hate crimes. Those are institutional hate crimes. And as long as those continue, there will be that fear from people of color. We have lived under segregation in the 50s when I was in school. We have lived under segregation from 1836 when the city of Austin was founded. And one of the things that I wanted to point out today is that statistically, as you all know, Austin is, for its size, is one of the most economically and racially segregated cities in the country.
Yes, it is.
We have lost from 16% to less than 8% of our African American brothers and sisters. That is through city policy. City of Austin Latino community was almost at 48% at one point. Now it's down to 40%. So what's happening to the people of color? Why are we being pushed out? It's city policy again. When we were in the early 70s, when we were trying to put together a deal with the city of Austin, and I'm proud to say that we were able to get Police Chief Bob Miles to resign at that time. We were asking for a citizens task force. That didn't happen back in the 70s. It's happened maybe sometime in the 90s, but it's nothing but has been and continues to be nothing but a paper tiger. We ask for subpoena powers. That doesn't happen. And people of color in this community are fearful. Every single day that we walk out that door, we do not know what is going to happen to us, what is going to happen to our children, what's going to happen to our elderly, because as they say, and I'll use BWB, breathing while black or breathing while brown, is not something that many people understand here in Austin, Texas. So Austin is and will continue to be, as long as we get a narrative to placate us in an attempt to silence us, we will continue to see what we see today for the last 150 some odd years.
Chief, can you respond specifically to the police aspect of Gilbert's response?
You know, I guess what I would say, we actually engaged a group called the Center for Policing Equity about a year and a half ago, and they initially wanted to come to us and do a study of the police department and look for disparities in how we police and the outcomes in how we police. And as with typical research groups, they promise you anonymity on the front end. They say, we just want to come in, we want to look at your data, we want to look at your practices, we want to look at your outcomes, and we want to author this report. However, we'll refer to you as a large police department in the Midwest, so therefore, you know, the results aren't public. Not only did we agree with participating, but we said from day one, we're the Austin Police Department and we'll stand by the outcomes of that study. So we're willing to recognize what we get right and recognize and address where we come up short. And that report uncovered exactly what we expected it to uncover, that there are disparate outcomes that occur in certain parts of our community. And we continue to work with the Center for Policing Equity, and we continue to address that report to monitor what we do and how we do it so that we can both account for and address those areas where we have disparate outcomes.
So our time is moving very quickly here, and this is clearly a discussion that we're starting today. We're not going to finish it today, and we hope that it continues for a long time. I do want to make sure that we have enough time to talk about solutions and to talk about how we move forward from Austin's racial climate, the situation we have now that you all have described, how we can start coming together in the wake of the serial bombings, but also just in the wake of the situation that we are hearing described today that exists in Austin. So I want to go to a question from a listener. What steps could both the city and residents do to alleviate the omission of people of color from Austin's success and to improve Austin's racial climate? So what do you all want to see? What can we do? And Chaz, you look ready to go first.
I'm trying to say this in a way that's appropriate for this broadcast. I think step one, or one of the steps, is that our white brothers and sisters are going to have to learn how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable while talking about race. I hate to put all that on white people, but to me, a lot of the world's ills and a lot of the ills here in Austin come with that. The fact that white people... We can't talk about race with white people just because they're afraid of being called racist is absurd to me. The fact that even as a, you know, I'm a black man, but as a man, I realize I have privilege. So, I had to learn over the years to be okay with being called maybe misogynistic or being called sexist, because it's a learning process through that. But until we can get to a place where white people can be comfortable or uncomfortable talking about race, I think we can have all these kind of panels and discussions we want, but that's at the crux of the problem, because white people, even though you may not think it, you know, and I'll say this because I believe it in my heart, and if you go through undoing racism trainings, you learn that white people, most white people, 99.9% of white people are racist. You benefit from racism. You benefit from capitalism. You benefit from white privilege. And until we can start having those kind of conversations, even if you look at this bombing thing, as I've been thinking about it over like the last couple of weeks and just in general, you know, people like to talk about black on black crime or brown on brown crime, but those crimes are a result of poverty and white supremacy and all these kind of things. But it's so privileged and so sick in a way that white people can go and kill people just because they want to, right? That's what this bomber did. He got up one day and was like, you know what? I feel like doing this. As opposed to black and brown communities and low income communities, a lot of that, a lot of violence and a lot of those things come from not having or the lack of, which is also a direct result of race. And I think until Austin really gets serious about, you know, again, I commend the mayor for the, you know, this really noble attempt to kill racism in Austin. But to really become an anti-racist city, that's going to take some really deep soul searching. And I don't know if we're there yet. I hope we are, but you know, even the fact that I read this article about our neighbors on the west side saying, well, we already know our neighbors. And that whole article reeked of privilege to me, right? Because you look at the east side to where the neighbors have changed so much to where the new neighbors probably don't even want to get to the old neighbors, right? And the old neighbors are black and brown. And I don't know. I think we have to come to a realization that everything deals with race. Everything deals with race. And until white people can accept that fact and get comfortable with being uncomfortable talking about it, just talking about it, because you don't have to live it like we do. But let's just talk about it and be okay with talking about it. Let's talk about the fact that when we talk about school closures, we're not talking about anything on the west side of 35. When we talk about the lack of resources for black and brown people in black and brown schools, we're not talking about anything on the west side of 35. Even with these bombers, when we talked about the bombings that were dropped off on doorsteps of people, they were on doorsteps of people of color. It wasn't a tripwire or anything like that. So, like, we have to be honest with ourselves and really deal with race. Even the way the media has covered this story, this troubled young man, no. If that was me or any other person in this room that has ample amounts of melanin in their skin, that story would have been a lot different. Was the young man troubled? Absolutely. But he was a troubled young man that turned out to be a domestic terrorist. But because he was white, we gave him the benefit of being a human first as opposed to a thing. So until we can start talking about race in a real way, you know, like Gilbert said, we'll be having this discussion next week and next month and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we have to talk about it.
And we do have a question from the audience at our microphone. Yes.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am. It's
yes. My name is Connie Kirk. 58 years ago, at the age of 13, I marched against segregation downtown on Congress to integrate Austin. My mother is Willie Mae Kirk, first black civil rights champion. My brother is Ron Kirk, first black mayor of Dallas, first black U.S. ambassador of trade. My father was Lee Kirk, grandson of a Buffalo soldier, first black employee at the post office was called a bunch of niggas. They refused to promote him. The manager used to meet him in the elevator to discuss his merits and why he wasn't being promoted because the manager said that he would be called a nigger lover. I went to white schools. We sat on one side, they sat on the other. I'm a professional jazz and blues singer. I won state championship and city singing. With that being said, I was probably the first black person to sit at the front of the bus because I used to sing in the back practicing my songs for competition. And the white folks on the bus loved to hear me sing. So they let me go up to the front to sing to everybody. Little did I know that I was making history. But I'm sick and tired of this. Excuse me, we have Klan members on the city council in Elgin. They changed the 19th of June parade and told the blacks that they could not have it on their celebration day. Okay, so we have some problems here. 15 years ago, I approached the mayor's office. I called and begged them to put tower cameras in East Austin because I saw it coming, okay? I've seen a lot of stuff. I'm born and raised on 11th Street at Holy Cross. I'm sick of it. We have not gotten rid of segregation until you face that point. Segregation is stronger now with 8% black population going on in East Austin. We don't have any votes. Y'all have taken everything from us. Everything. And white people coming down the sidewalk, greeting me and letting their dogs poop in my yard. I say, if you don't get that stuff out of my yard, this is my place. What I want to know, had y'all put the cameras up 15 years ago, they said that our neighborhood wouldn't pay for the cameras. Why do the residents have to pay? You have all these festivals that pour money into Austin. You need to start using festival money for better causes. Why do we have to pay for more police protection over in East Austin? Okay, I believe that bomb, first of all, I don't believe that the masterminder has been caught. I don't. I think that young man was a recruit. And if y'all don't get on it and put tower cameras strategically in Austin to protect all of us, yes, white people get upset when you talk about racism and all of that, but they're like children. Until you teach people not to hate, until you teach people that we have the right just as much as others do, you need to start pouring money into East Austin schools because that's a way of keeping us down too. No education, no tutoring programs. We need better teachers. We need tutors over there. I'm tutoring 5 children every week. Why am I doing it?
So
that's what I want to know.
Yes, thank you so much. And I'd love to hear panelists' response, please. Anybody, go right ahead.
Well, I think I know, and probably we all know why they don't want cameras in East Austin. It'll show what's happening, the real thing that's happening in East Austin, not what we hear in the media. I personally think that a couple of things that we always get whenever incidents like this happen, or whenever a black young man or woman or a brown young man and woman gets killed, one of the first things that's mentioned by city hall, city council, all the powers that be, the police department, etc., we need better training. I've heard that we need better training BS since the 60s. We need more brown and black cops. We don't need brown and black cops. We need better training. Because my history with black and brown cops has been about the same as my history with white cops. They're trained to hurt you before they ask, why are you having problems? I have gone to meetings where police have surrounded, standing up with not this current police chief, but others. They're standing around with the meanest looking faces that they can produce, fully armed with bulletproof vests, with their arms crossed, intimidating you, attempting to intimidate you, because that's the way it's done. They want us scared. They want us not to get up and say, what the hell is going on, and we better get it right. I think that better training is definitely something that needs to be done within the police department, and I think better training on institutional racism should be done at all city levels. Because if we don't do that, the city has institutionalized racism. And if we don't deal with it at all levels, if we only deal with it at the police department, we're going to feel it at the tax office. We're going to feel it when new people are moving to East Austin and pushing us out. We got we talk about the 1928 master plan that moved everybody to East Austin. Well, now we've got the Imagine Austin master plan that's moving us further east of East Austin. So I call it the Imagine Austin Without Poor People plan.
So I want
that is what it is. So Code Next is according to our elected officials downtown, I'm very disappointed on the 10-1 because 90% of the people that are sitting downtown have drank the urbanist Kool-Aid.
And Gilbert, thank you so much for your thoughts.
You.
We've only got a few minutes left. Our time has gone so quickly. I want to give Chief Maley an opportunity to speak, and Emlyn also responding to our audience and also about moving forward.
So I'll talk a little bit about training, because I too am a strong proponent of training. Training is not the solution for everything, but without it, you're guaranteed to have future failures, and we have to learn from our past. Steps we have taken to address some of the issues: we put the entire police department through fair and impartial police training last year. Actually, Chaz, you came to the session with all of the executive team to both identify and understand biases, but then also to make sure that biases don't impact how you police. Again, we know that we have some disparate income impacts, and we look at that. We are currently putting together de-escalation training for the entire department. Now, we've had that rooted in our training for years, but we recognize the need to continue with that, and we're putting together a training that will go out to all of the department. Chaz and his group at Austin Justice Coalition came to us a little over a year ago and had concerns with our policy on use of force, which is what we call response to resistance in Austin, because you shouldn't be using force unless you're responding to some level of resistance. And they came to us with some concerns, but they also came to us with a solution. They had drafted a policy that they thought addressed the concerns that they brought forward, along with de-escalation. We had been working on our own de-escalation policy, but we looked at what the Justice Coalition brought to us, and we realized that they had done a really good job and had put a lot of work into it. So we worked with Justice Coalition, and we implemented the de-escalation policy that rolled out many months back. And I can tell you that the majority of the language in our policy was language that was written by Justice Coalition, because it was appropriate and it met the needs of the department as well as the needs of the community. So we're always willing to address the needs for additional training. I sit here and tell you we are not perfect and we're not going to be perfect, but as we will learn from when we come up short, and we will implement the best training that we can. And then the last thing I'll add, because I know you've got other panelists, is on the issue of cameras. We are putting body cameras on every single Austin police officer because we want to have that level of accountability, and we want to have every opportunity to capture what's happening.
Emlyn, also, we just have a couple minutes left. Your response.
And I think for, you know, to create a more equitable and just community, it's really for us to be intentional. And so that's for every level. You know, if you talk about the city, the people that are in power, you really need to be intentional of, you know, who's on your board, who's on your staff, who are the leaders, and then with the training, how are they going to be able to serve and really hear the voices, especially those of the marginalized communities. And so, you know, it's hard because I know we're such a solutions-driven like society, and it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, clearly this is, you know, 400 plus years of just institutional racism. And so how do we build it a community together is just through individual intentionality and then a collective intentionality. And so, you know, especially for the white community, it's like you don't go to East Austin just for yoga and for, you know, a nice taco. It's like you need to step outside your comfort zone and really befriend people, not just out of your comfort and your convenience, but really make a friend to want to be a friend and hold their back and be there with them.
I want to thank you all so much. I wish we had more time. We've had a wonderful discussion this morning. We are coming to the end of our time, and I want to thank our panelists this morning. Emlyn Lee is founder and community collaborator at Brave Communities, building relationships, awareness, voices, engagement, and communities. Gilbert Rivera is president of the Rosewood Neighborhood Association. Chaz Moore is executive director and founder of the Austin Justice Coalition. Brian Manley is interim police chief in Austin. We want to thank you all so much for coming today. We want to thank the George Washington Carver Museum, Cultural and Genealogy Center in Austin, for hosting us today. We also want to thank our live audience for joining us at the Carver. And we want to thank our engineer, Jake Perlman, for getting this broadcast on the air today. Thanks to all of you so much. You can find more news and keep up with coverage at KUT.org. I'm Jennifer Staten. It's 9:59. This is KUT 90.5.